Support for this Public Radio Tulsa podcast is provided by Chamber Music Tulsa, who presents the Lysander Piano Trio live in concert at the Tulsa Performing Arts Center October 13th. For more information, visit chambermusictulsa.org. Johannes Brahms could spend decades writing draft after draft of the same piece, so it's not surprising that he would be haunted for years by pieces that didn't quite meet his expectations. His first piano trio from 1854 was so disappointing that Brahms didn't write another for more than a quarter of a century. And when he finally composed this piece, his second piano trio, in 1882, he went in a completely new direction, creating an exceptionally taut and lean work with scarcely a wasted note. It's Johannes Brahms' second piano trio, Opus 87, in 10 minutes or less. I'm Jason Heilman. When a 20-year-old Johannes Brahms knocked on Robert Schumann's door in October of 1853, he came away with a lot more than he bargained for. Schumann was so impressed by the young man that he immediately wrote an editorial in his magazine hailing him as the composer destined to give ultimate expression to the era. Needless to say, this effusive praise put a lot of pressure on Brahms, who had yet to publish a single piece by this point. But Brahms also gained a valuable ally after that fateful meeting in Dusseldorf. It wasn't Robert himself. He would suffer his mental breakdown less than 6 months later. Instead, Brahms forged an immediate bond with Robert's wife, Clara Wieck Schumann. When Robert was committed to an asylum, Brahms moved into the Schumanns' house to help Clara with the household, and he stayed there for most of the next 2 years. It's obvious that during that time, Brahms fell in love with Clara Schumann, but their relationship seems to have remained platonic. Clara, like Brahms, was an immensely talented pianist who already had her own international performing career when her husband's tragedy struck, and Brahms frequently sought her advice on his early compositions. It was while he was staying at the Schumanns' house that Brahms finished his first piano trio, and although Clara had some misgivings about the piece, it had all the hallmarks of a young composer still trying to find himself, she encouraged him to publish it, and even wrote to Robert's publisher to make that possible in 1854. But Brahms, the consummate perfectionist, was never completely satisfied with his long-winded first piano trio. Yet rather than following it up with another piano trio right away, he stopped composing in the genre altogether. For the next 2 decades, Brahms focused on writing both a symphony and a string quartet, creating and throwing away draft after draft of both pieces, while publishing only a handful of chamber works in other genres, like his 2 string sextets and 2 of his piano quartets. It was only after the breakthrough success of his German Requiem in 1869 that Brahms was able to complete his 1st string quartet and his 1st symphony, finally making good on Robert Schumann's prediction from all those years ago. After the triumphant premiere of his 2nd symphony in 1877, Brahms felt confident enough to revisit a pair of genres that had caused him trouble early in his career. 4 years later, in 1881, he premiered his massive 2nd piano concerto, which represented a complete rethink of the genre, following the fiasco of his 1st piano concerto nearly 20 years earlier. The very next year, Brahms composed his 2nd piano trio, a piece that shows just how much Brahms had grown as a composer over the past 28 years. Brahms completed his C major 2nd piano trio in the summer of 1882, while he was vacationing in the Alpine spa town of Bad Ischl. Interestingly, Brahms worked on this new trio while he was composing 2 other very different pieces, his Song of the Fates for chorus, which is one of his bleakest works, and his much more upbeat string quintet in F major. In a way, the 2nd piano trio seems to take on aspects of both of these other pieces, charting a careful path between exuberance and gloominess. The trio opens energetically in its home key of C major with this almost heroic sounding theme. This leaping melody has a lot in common with the opening to Brahms' equally heroic 3rd symphony, which he had just started composing at the same time. In the trio, this heroic opening mood soon dissipates and grows more subdued or nostalgic for the movement's contrasting second theme. The development of these two themes and their return just before the end forms the fundamental basis of the first movement. But Brahms is happy to throw the listener a few curveballs here and there, including what sounds like it's going to be a repeat of the movement's main themes that instead leads into an extended development section. The second movement is a theme in variations based on one of Brahms' most expressive melodies set in the brooding key of A minor. This theme, with its characteristic snap rhythm, seems to have been inspired by Hungarian folk music, and Brahms subjects it to five increasingly dramatic variations. For the third movement, Brahms stays in the minor mode and opens with a scherzo melody that bristles with nervous energy. But that nervous mood doesn't last very long, and Brahms quickly transitions into a flowing melody that dominates most of the brief movement, which only transitions back to the nervous opening music just before the end. For the finale, Brahms shakes off all the seriousness of the middle movements and returns to the bright key of C major, more or less, with a vigorous melody at the outset. That melody has always reminded me of the theme from The Jetsons, or even The Simpsons. Now, we don't tend to associate Brahms with zany cartoon wackiness, so the fact that he created such an upbeat and rhythmically propulsive melody in this trio is pretty remarkable. This opening theme keeps coming back throughout the final movement, but gets sidetracked a few times by contrasting music as the piece races to its exuberant coda. After its official premiere in December of 1882, with the composer himself at the keyboard, Brahms published his C major piano trio the following year as his Opus 87. Critics have accused the piece of being too lightweight and superficial compared to his other chamber pieces, but I think that the piece represents the lessons that Brahms learned from his first piano trio, namely, that less can be more. Just a few years later, in 1889, Brahms actually went back and revised his earlier first piano trio, cutting more than 450 measures from the piece to create the version that we hear most often today. But Brahms would never have any second thoughts about his second piano trio. If his previous effort was too long and bloated, this new piece is taut and lean, with scarcely a note wasted. This was Johannes Brahms' Opus 87 piano trio in C major in 10 minutes or less. For Public Radio Tulsa's Classical Tulsa, I'm Jason Heilman. Thanks for listening.